Let's begin our session by praying together. Creator of the vastness of the galaxies, of the variety and beauty of our little planet, of the joy and happiness that comes through personal relationships, we worship you and praise you and pledge ourselves to be faithful to you. In the name of Jesus our Lord, amen. Last evening we talked together about what nuclear war would be like and whether or not it was likely to happen. Today we're building on that and asking the question, what's a Christian response to this kind of situation? How do we respond faithfully as people who confess Jesus Christ as Lord? And I'm going to take this in two parts. There are two major traditions in the Christian church with regard to the question of war and violence. The major tradition, the one that most Christians most of the time have affirmed, has been the just war tradition. From the time of St. Augustine in the 4th century, from the time of Constantine onward, the Christian church, by and large, has believed that under certain circumstances, reluctantly, wars needed to be fought for the preservation of justice and order and peace. St. Augustine articulated this viewpoint most systematically for the early centuries. Christian theologians since his time have reaffirmed and elaborated that, and the just war traditions have been a major cluster of ideas that Christians have used to struggle with the question of war. And today, I want to take that tradition and apply it to the nuclear question and ask, what is the conclusion with regard to nuclear war if we start out in the just war tradition, which is the tradition of the majority of Christians? Tomorrow, I want to take the other tradition, which is the pacifist or nonviolent tradition, and apply that tradition, develop that tradition, show how it's argued, and then apply it to our question. Tomorrow, even more strongly than today, I want to underline the fact that I think that far more important than the differences between those two traditions is the fact that they lead us in a similar direction on the nuclear question. But more of that tomorrow. Into the mic. Okay, yeah. You're losing me and so on. Okay, let's see. Marvelous. Closer. Thanks, Dan. Is that all right now? Is that coming through better? If I don't look all around, well, then it's all right. Is that it? Okay, the just war tradition. Let me start with three quotations, actually four, that all stand within the just war tradition. The first one is by Harold O.J. Brown, who teaches systematic theology at a seminary in Chicago. He says, "A war between the United States and the Soviet Union would be terribly destructive and might actually eradicate human civilization or human life itself. But our nation's only hope remaining free is to be prepared to go to war to defend itself, even at the risk of being destroyed. Christians may be the free world's hope of remaining free, for it is we alone who can dare to risk losing much or all in war to forestall what we consider a still greater evil, the world domination of a totalitarian atheistic system. In short, because we believe in God and the resurrection, we can risk destroying the world." The second statement is by Michael Walzer, who teaches political science at Harvard and has done one of the major books in this century on the just war tradition. And he says, "We threaten evil in order not to do it, And the doing of it would be so terrible that the threat seems, in comparison, to be morally defensible. John Stott, an Anglican widely known in evangelical Protestant circles, says, "Every Christian, whatever he may think of the possibility of a just use of conventional weapons, must be a nuclear pacifist." And finally, Vatican II, "Any act of war aimed indiscriminately at the destruction of entire cities or of extensive areas along with their population is a crime against God and man himself. It merits unequivocal and unhesitating condemnation." Now, what are the just war criteria? Let me just run through these quickly to remind you of what they are before we try to apply them. The first one is last resort. And I'll just jot these up here quickly. If a war is to be just, it must be fought as a last resort. All other means to the morally just solution of a conflict must have been exhausted before you resorted to arms. The second criterion is just cause. You must be fighting for justice. I'm using, by the way, Edward Long, War and Conscience in America, basically here in these criteria. He says, "War can be just only if employed to defend a stable order or a morally preferable cause against threats of destruction or the use of injustice. The goals for which you fight must be just, and the opponent must be clearly unjust," even though, of course, everyone recognizes moral ambiguity everywhere. The third criterion is a right attitude. A right attitude. Now, that criterion means that your motive must be right. You must be concerned with justice, not with revenge or retaliation. Anger, revenge, retaliation dare have no role in a just war, according to the just war tradition. Finally, there must be, and not finally, fourthly, there must be a prior declaration of war. The purpose of this is to give the opponent a fair notice and to give the opponent an opportunity to rethink the situation and decide whether or not he really does want to risk the horror of war. The fifth, sixth, and seventh criteria are the ones that are most important for us in the nuclear question. I'll spend just a bit more time outlining them. Fifth one is that there must be a reasonable hope of success, a reasonable hope of success. War may be conducted only by military means that promise a reasonable attainment of the moral and political objectives being sought. If there's no reasonable chance of success, then it's wrong to fight no matter how just one's cause is. And that doesn't just mean that you think you can win. Some of you may have seen the cartoon that shows in a totally bombed out landscape after a nuclear holocaust and two people stick their heads up out of a sort of a tin that somehow managed to escape, and the one says to the other, "There's a rumor going around that we won." Now, that's not what this criterion is talking about. It means that there's a reasonable hope of actually preserving what you're fighting for, in our case, justice and freedom and democracy and a livable society. The sixth criteria is non-combatant immunity. Talking about the civilians who are not connected with the armed forces. Non-combatant immunity. The just war theory has always entailed selective immunity for certain parts of the enemy's population, particularly non-combatants. Non-combatants are all of those folk who are not directly involved in the manufacture, direction, or use of weapons. Now, in a just war, no military action may be aimed directly at non-combatants. To aim directly at non-combatants, to aim directly at civilians, is murder, according to the just war tradition. That does not mean that civilians may never get killed. The just war tradition has always said that if an army aims justly at a military target and some nearby non-combatants get hurt or killed, that's okay. It's in fact called unintended side effect or double effect. And that's permissible within limits. Although the seventh criterion, which is proportionality, also applies there. The seventh and final criterion that we'll look at is proportionality. It says that there must be a reasonable expectation that the good results of the war will exceed the horrible evils involved in fighting. The good results must be greater than the horrible evils that we expect to experience. That applies to the whole war and also to limited segments within it. Now, according to the just war tradition, a war is just only if all of those criteria are met. The cause for which you go to war and the methods by which one fights must be just. Now, we need to apply that to the nuclear question, and that's not just a simple matter because there are a number of scenarios. We can distinguish four basic scenarios. It depends on whether or not you're targeting cities or just military targets and so on. I'm going to focus four scenarios. One, an all-out nuclear war in which both sides shoot roughly all of their nuclear weapons and they aim at everything, including cities. All-out nuclear war. That, of course, is declared policy. Second, a limited nuclear war in which both sides aim at a few cities, but it's limited. You know, they take out Detroit, we take out Leningrad, and that goes back and forth a couple times, and then we stop. That would be a second scenario. Limited nuclear war against cities. That's sometimes called limited counterpopulation warfare. The third scenario would be a limited war in which only military targets are aimed at. That would be limited counterforce warfare, if you want the technical term. And then finally, there are some people who say it would always be wrong to use nuclear weapons, but we need to possess them. And we need to look at that. So those are the four scenarios. I'll focus primarily on the first and fourth, but have a little bit to say about the intervening two as well. Are those four scenarios clear and why we need to distinguish those? Okay. First of all, total nuclear war. A large number of U.S. and Russian missiles are aimed at targets that include large population centers. Since the early 50s, the United States has repeatedly warned the Soviet Union that a nuclear attack would trigger a large-scale retaliatory nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. In order to protect Western Europe, we've also threatened a nuclear attack if Russia were to invade Western Europe with conventional weapons. In that case, we've said we would strike first. A first strike possibility, largely because of that concern to protect Western Europe against a conventional attack by Russia, a first strike possibility has never been given up. No American president has been willing to say that the U.S. will not use nuclear weapons first. Now, in the 70s, U.S. policy shifted somewhat. More Soviet missile installations were targeted. We aimed more of our missiles at their military installations. And there was heated debate about the possibility of limited nuclear war just aimed at military installations. But a massive retaliatory strike on the Soviet Union, killing perhaps 100 million people at least, continues as the cornerstone of U.S. policy. There's absolutely no uncertainty about the current declared policy of the U.S. and NATO. Top government leaders have repeatedly declared that if attacked, they would unleash near total annihilation of the Soviet Union. In 1958, President Eisenhower said that U.S. bombers present to any attacker the prospect of virtual annihilation of his own country
Even if we assume a surprise attack, he went on our own bases, our bombers would immediately be on their way in sufficient strength to accomplish the, notice the words, the mission of retaliation. British government sources have said the same thing. McNamara, I'll quote, yet in 1968, Defense Secretary McNamara of the U.S. said to Congress, "It is the clear and present ability to destroy the attacker as a 20th century nation and an unwavering will to use those forces in retaliation to a nuclear attack that provides the deterrent. Mutual assured destruction, the destruction of the population centers of the Soviet Union, is current declared policy of our country." Now, we need to apply these criteria to that kind of situation. I'm not going to say much about the first ones. I think that if we were attacked first, you might argue successfully that it was a last resort. I don't have any trouble, frankly, in thinking that the cause would be just. I don't think that the Soviet Union is a demonic force that's totally evil, but I think it's a totalitarian regime that is vastly inferior to the democratic societies of Western Europe and North America, and I'd like to protect those societies. So that I think struggling to preserve our freedom is a just cause. Right attitude? Well, the government documents that we've looked at repeatedly talk about retaliation. According to the just war tradition, that's totally unacceptable. Prior declaration of war, that one's ambiguous. Only Congress can declare war. Obviously, with 30 minutes to respond, you're not going to assemble the Congress and have a debate about whether or not you should respond. You might argue that the fact that we've had a declared policy for 30 years, that if attacked, we'll respond, functions as a legitimate prior declaration of war. What about the last three? Those are the crucial ones. The reasonable hope of success, non-combatant immunity, and proportionality. First of all, reasonable hope of success. It stipulates, remember, that there must be a likelihood not just of winning, but of also preserving what we're fighting for. So when Harold O.J. Brown, the theologian that I quoted at the beginning, implies that we should fight an all-out war, even though it's likely, quote, to eradicate human civilization itself, as he himself says, that violates one of the fundamental criteria of the just war. If there's no chance of preserving the civilization you're trying to preserve, then it's wrong to go to war, according to this criteria. In the chaos and the disorder after a nuclear war, I think that all the things that we were fighting for, justice, freedom, democracy, the rule of law, even our affluent lifestyle, would be destroyed. The Office of Technology Assessment that I've referred to details the ghastly obliteration of both countries, suggesting that at best life would be at the level of the Middle Ages afterward. The survivors, if any, President Carter said, would live in despair amid the poisoned ruins of a civilization that had committed suicide. In short, in an all-out nuclear war, there's no chance of preserving what we're fighting for. I think Pope John XXIII put it best when he said, "In this age of ours, which prides itself on its atomic power, it is irrational to think that war is a proper way to obtain justice for violated rights." So I would say that an all-out nuclear war fails on the fifth criterion, without any question. The sixth criterion is non-combatant immunity. Civilians dare not be aimed at directly. Most Christians from all Christian traditions, whether evangelical Protestant, mainline Protestant, Catholic, who have carefully studied and applied the just war criteria to the question of nuclear war, conclude that precisely this criterion, perhaps more than any of the others, prohibits nuclear war, especially all-out nuclear war. According to the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment that I referred to yesterday, an all-out nuclear war would kill 70 to 160 million Americans, 100 million to 130 million Russians. That, of course, those people would be largely civilians that we would be aiming at, intending to kill. John Stott says, and I quote him at a little more length, "I believe the same principle of non-combatant immunity is sufficient to condemn the use of strategic nuclear weapons. Because they're indiscriminate in their effects, destroying combatants and non-combatants alike, it seems clear to me that they are ethically indefensible. And then he goes on to say that every Christian today, even if they are in the just war tradition and are not pacifists, must be nuclear pacifists. In the official documents of Vatican II, you get a very interesting, exceedingly strong statement. They say, any act of war aimed indiscriminately at the destruction of entire cities or of extensive areas along with their population is a crime against God and man himself. And then the final statement, it merits unequivocal and unhesitating condemnation. Now you catch the gravity of that statement only when you realize that that word condemnation, it's the word anathema, which of course has a very strong, long tradition in the Catholic Church. That word is used once in 103,000 words in the documents of Vatican II. It's used here in condemning any nuclear war that is aimed at population centers. In other words, it's picking up precisely this criterion and saying that it's immoral and Christians must be totally opposed to any nuclear war of that sort. As Brian Herrick, one of the prominent Catholic ethicists who studied this question, says, this statement by the Vatican Council prohibits the use of all present strategic, that is intercontinental, nuclear weapons for Catholics. In the 1976, the U.S. Catholic bishops went even further. They said that it was morally wrong even to threaten to use nuclear weapons in this way. And the Catholic Church is right now in the middle of a major study struggling with this question. There's some possibility that they will even come to the conclusion this fall that even possessing nuclear weapons is immoral, but that's still in process and it's not at all clear. Paul Ramsey, who is one of the most prominent Protestant ethicists who has studied the whole question of the just war, says this about an all-out retaliatory strike on the Soviet Union after they had struck us. He says that the present policy of targeting nuclear weapons on population centers is totally immoral. Even after our cities had been attacked, he says, destroying Soviet cities would be like shooting the children of a criminal. It would be an act of pure, purposeless punishment and retrospective vengeance. Remember the third criterion, the right attitude. The concern must be justice and the preservation of order and peace and the right relationship between societies. It dare not be revenge or retaliation. The purpose of nuclear weapons, of course, is to deter nuclear attack. Ramsey continues, if our cities were already destroyed by a Soviet first strike, the only reason for obliterating their population centers would be vengeance, a motive for the Christian faith and the just war tradition unequivocally condemns. Ramsey says, finally, that such an act of massive retaliation would be the most immoral because the most stupid and politically purposeless act in the whole history of warfare. But that policy is the declared intention of our government, for which we regularly contribute taxes to build the weapons to do that. The final criterion is proportionality. That criterion demands that the good results outweigh the bad results. The purpose of a just war is the restoration of a right relationship between two societies. Now, obviously, if one society or both societies are destroyed in the process, there's no longer any possibility of a right relationship existing between them. Surely, when you're talking about a policy that the U.S. government itself says would kill 100 million to 130 to 190 million Americans, and 100 to 130 million Russians, surely that kind of policy is out of all proportion to the ends that we're trying to achieve. I would want to argue that when you consider the deaths, the long-term ecological consequences, et cetera, that one needs to conclude that it would be a greater evil to fight that kind of war than not to fight it. The historian Herbert Butterfield has said that with modern weapons, we could easily put civilization back thousands of years. While the course of a single century can produce a colossal transformation from despotic regimes to a system of liberty, within 100 years, it says, you can have amazing movement from despotism to increasing freedom. Now, of course, there are a lot of Americans who disagree. Like Harold O.J. Brown, whom I quoted, they really believe the slogan that it's better dead than red. Again, I think that Russian totalitarianism is an awful thing. I don't think there's any point in being naive. There's no point in doing what I think the American left sometimes does, and that is to paint a kind of rosy picture of Russian society. It hasn't been pleasant and nice, and millions of people have died. But it's bad history, and it's worse theology, to claim that Soviet control of the world would destroy Christianity. Christians have flourished, after all, under totalitarian regimes at many points in history. Despotic Roman emperors couldn't destroy Christian faith. In fact, they couldn't even prevent it spreading rapidly. Modern totalitarians in Russia and China have been unable to do any better. A higher percentage of the population in Russia attends church every Sunday morning than in Western Europe, the land of the Reformation. Even Billy Graham no longer believes that the present differences between East and West would justify a nuclear war. And I quote him, "The opportunities I've had to visit Yugoslavia, Hungary, and Poland have been very significant." Billy says, "I went with many stereotypes in my mind, but I came away with a new understanding, especially of how the church exists and in some instances thrives in these societies, and a new awareness of our concern for peace. No, I do not think the present differences are worth nuclear war." I think one must conclude that according to the just war principles, an all-out nuclear attack would be a totally immoral, sinful act. Christians dare not participate in that. They dare not prepare for it. They dare have no part in it. And since, as our Secretary of Defense McNamara and his successors have said, the ability and unwavering will to do precisely that is at the heart of current U.S. and Western European strategies, as, of course, it's at the heart of Russian strategy, all Christians in all those places, it seems to me, must join together and say no to those plans. What about a limited nuclear attack in cities? Instead of talking about a massive all-out war, we're talking about Detroit and Leningrad and perhaps New York and Moscow. Probably the rest of the country wouldn't really object if New York was to disappear, but that's not really the point. I think the same point that I've already made, namely that aiming at civilians is murder, according to just war tradition, simply precludes a more limited nuclear war. Somebody has said that, in fact, it's been argued by the futurologist Herman Kahn that it's not nearly so bad to destroy a few cities as it is to destroy them all. And I think the right response to that is that, yes, there's a sense in which that's true. It's also true that it's not nearly so bad to rape one woman as it is to rape 50. But that doesn't justify the first rape. Neither is the first city that's aimed at to be justified. Limited nuclear attack on military targets. Again, you run into the same problems. Paul Ramsey is the person who has given the most energy to defending this approach, and I've got a big section in the book where I deal with that, but it gets a little technical, so I'm not going to deal with that here, except to say briefly that he ends up saying that a policy which says we will aim at military installations would work as a deterrent precisely because we know and they know, first of all, that it would kill a large number of civilians. And so his deterrence ends up working because he still knows that his approach will kill civilians. Now, he wants to justify it because he says, I don't aim at them. But it wouldn't work unless, in fact, they were going to get killed. And so it really doesn't change things much. I think that finally, if you take a look at his argument, that doesn't work either. But where does that leave us? If it would be wrong, according to the just war tradition, to have an all-out nuclear war. It would be wrong to aim at a few cities. It would be wrong to have a nuclear exchange just aimed at military and economic targets. Does that mean that we're forced to unilateral disarmament? Brian Hare, the Catholic ethicist that I mentioned, his name is spelled H-E-H-I-R, by the way, if you're interested. He's an interesting guy. He's a Jesuit, works in Washington for the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops, trained at Harvard in political science, I think under Kissinger, and a very, very sharp guy. Hare thinks there is an alternative. Hare says that it would always be wrong to use nuclear weapons. This is the fourth position that I promised to talk about. But, he says, it's okay to develop, stockpile, and install nuclear weapons. He calls himself a nuclear pacifist on the use of nuclear weapons. But he wants us to keep our nuclear arsenal, and in fact to keep updating it, keep it up to the state of the art, for the sake of deterrence. He says the mere possession of a devastating deterrent means that the adversary can never be sure it will not be used. In any rational calculation, that should be enough to deter. In other words, even if we say we're not going to use it, they'll never know if we really mean it. And so they won't attack us. And if that's not enough, then he says, in Christian faith, we cannot do more than that. If one never intends to use nuclear weapons, then it's not immoral to possess them. Now that's tempting, isn't it? If you fear, as I suspect many of us do, Russian totalitarianism, then that may seem like a tempting option. If we could be very certain that deterrence would continue to prevent nuclear war, then Hare's position, I think, would be attractive. But that's a big if. If we could be sure. I think, as a matter of fact, that most of us, most Americans, have come to live so comfortably with nuclear weapons precisely because we think they'll never be used. But I think Harris' position is problematic at three crucial points, and I want to develop those. First of all, Harris' position tends to justify current policy without changing it at all. I'll develop that in a moment. Second, Harris' position destroys the credibility of deterrence by announcing that we're not going to use them. And third, it increases the risk of accidental nuclear war because we continue to develop and employ ever more dangerous nuclear weapons. Let me just develop each of those briefly. First of all, no present government has indicated the slightest interest whatsoever in accepting a Harris approach, that we will possess them but say we're not going to use them. So the theologians who take this position end up offering a rationale for continuing to develop and install nuclear weapons without having any impact on public policy. The practical effect, therefore, is simply to justify the way we're going. And the second point, which is that it destroys the credibility of deterrence. Every public figure who has commented on deterrence makes it clear that deterrence works only if the Soviet Union believes that we will use our nuclear weapons. Former Secretary of Defense McNamara again, and everyone else says the same thing. It's the clear and present ability to destroy the attacker as a 20th century nation and an unwavering will to use those forces in retaliation for nuclear attack that provides a deterrent. That's what makes it work, McNamara says. Now, of course, Brian here knows that. But his proposal to possess but never use nuclear weapons destroys the very deterrence that he hopes to preserve. There would be one way out of that dilemma, of course, and that would be to keep our intention not to use nuclear weapons the number one secret of the nation. Only the president and a few people around him would know about it. The problem with that is that everybody else in the country would have to assume that we intend to use them. And we've just concluded that using them would be murder according to just war tradition. So everybody in the country, the people who pay for them, the people who do scientific research on them, the people who install them, and the people who handle them, would all be involved in the intention to commit murder. And of course, as this tradition points out, the intention to commit murder somewhere down in the future is murderous as well. So that doesn't work. There's a third and final, and I think most serious, objection to Brian Hare's position that we should possess them but not use them. The validity of Harris' position rests on the assumption that continuing to possess nuclear weapons does not involve us in immoral risks. I think the evidence suggests the contrary, although we'll have to talk about that, and of course there's room for disagreement here. The risks of nuclear war increase year by year. We came close in the Cuban Missile Crisis. I talked about the computer failures in 79 and 80 and the 140 false alarms that Barry Goldwater mentioned in one 18-month period. There's a chilling article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists of November 1980. It shows how human error could lead to a nuclear catastrophe. It talks about the fact that because of emotional problems, drug use, and so on, about 5,000 military personnel already working with nuclear weapons are removed every year from the program. One Army Code specialist, this report in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists says, one Army Code specialist reported, and I quote, missile soldiers, the soldiers handing missiles, sometimes were high when they attached nuclear warheads to the missiles. So were soldiers, he said, who connected the two pieces up to make the missile operational. On September 18, 1980, a technician accidentally dropped a wrench 70 feet onto the fuel tank of a multi-megaton Titan missile. There was an explosion that pulverized the silo's 750-ton door. It dug a crater 250 feet deep. The nuclear warhead was probably hurled several hundred feet out of the silo, although that's classified information, and we're not sure. Mercifully, it didn't explode. The report of near catastrophe goes on and on. No one reading this carefully researched article, I think, can feel any optimism about indefinitely avoiding nuclear war. Part of the problem in this connection is the pace of technological change itself. The pace of technological change tends to destabilize the situation and undermine deterrence. Both sides, of course, mistrust each other. Both fear the other may make a technological breakthrough that would give them a significant advantage. So they both continue feverishly to develop more and more sophisticated, more and more deadly nuclear weapons. Of course, a major technological breakthrough would make it more dangerous, not less dangerous, for the side, for both sides. On the one hand, the elaborate spying networks of both sides almost guarantee that the other side would pick up enough information from the breakthrough, about the breakthrough, to be very, very frightened. Now, we would almost certainly discover that the Russians had made some important breakthrough, even though we didn't know exactly what it was and couldn't instantly duplicate it. We would be scared to death, perhaps so frightened that we would strike first before they took advantage of their advantage. Hare himself points out how the pace of technological change actually increases the problems of control. One example from the past, and one from the present and immediate future. In 1971, the U.S. had 1,656 deliverable warheads. 3 years later, we had 8,000. The reason was the new technology of MIRV. M-I-R-V, capital letters all. Multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles is what it stands for. It simply means that at the cone of each of our missiles, we're able to put several nuclear warheads that are independently targeted. And when the missile gets over Russia, they take off for their different targets. So instead of one missile up there, we have several. We had the technology, we were ahead of the Russians. It was technologically possible for us to MIRV our missiles, and so we did it. But it didn't make it safer. The Russians very soon learned how to do it too, and the only thing that we'd really gained was the fact that we couldn't count very precisely exactly how many nuclear warheads were up at the cone of each missile. If you just had one warhead per silo, it was fairly easy to count by satellite and so on. The same kind of thing, only more frighteningly so, is in the process of happening with the cruise and MX missiles. Cruise missiles are so small, about 20 feet in length, that they can be hidden almost anywhere. You could hide them, a lot of them, or a number in a room like this. Their deadly accuracy against enemy missiles encourages a launch on warning policy. Because they have first strike capability, you see, because they're so accurate, within 100 feet or so, they give us the possibility of trying to wipe out all the other side's missiles. That means that the reaction time is even shorter, especially if you put those cruise missiles out on submarines and out on ships at sea, where there's less than 30 minutes reaction time. And so the other side's tempted to put their missiles on an automatic computer launch on warning. When the computer says that our missiles are coming in, they will automatically launch their missiles to make sure that they don't get all of their missiles trapped in their silos and in other places where they are. In 1981, late 81, the Reagan administration announced plans to deploy some 384 long-range cruise missiles on ships, on submarines and surface ships. At the same time, he said he was going to build 1,480 almost identical cruise missiles, but they would have conventional warheads. Secretary of Defense admitted that it would be extremely difficult to tell the difference between the two kinds of missiles. So the other side will not be able to tell which is which. The chief negotiators for SALT 1 and 2 are very worried. If the U.S. proceeds, this development would be the first installation of cruise missiles on ships. Because of their small size, 20 feet, any small ship, including a Russian or an American fishing boat, could be a nuclear delivery vehicle. And there would be no way of knowing which of the trawlers off the coast had those cruise missiles and which didn't. Experts believe that the decision could devastate efforts to control the arms race. Why this new development? It's technologically possible. And when something is technologically possible in our society, we do it. But the result is not more security. It's more danger because it shortens reaction time in every way. It increases the danger. Robert McNamara talked about what he called the mad momentum intrinsic to the development of all nuclear weaponry. He was talking about the internal logic of the technological development, the mad momentum intrinsic to the development of all nuclear weaponry. Every year that we continue the present policy of adopting new nuclear weapons, as soon as technology makes them possible, we edge closer, I think, to the day when deterrence will fail. James Schlesinger, President Nixon's Secretary of Defense, called for a limited war strategy because he feared that deterrence would fail. To gamble on deterrence working indefinitely is to cling to an increasingly shaky reed. I find it striking that those who propose some variation on Hare's position, we possess them, but we don't use them, always justify it in terms of an interim approach. Already back in 1961, John Bennett, the famous ethicist at Union in New York, did that. He rejected any use of nuclear retaliation against noncombatants, and he admitted that the logical conclusion might seem to be unilateral nuclear disarmament, 1961. But he said, such a position is psychologically and politically impossible. And that's a quote. Therefore, he argued, there is an interim situation which does provide a basis for the possession of nuclear weapons, 1961. In 1977, PRS Corden of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency said the same kind of thing. Brian Harris says the same thing in 1982. My question is, how long will this increasingly dangerous interim situation last? Every year the danger of nuclear war increases. It's time, I think, to reject an upward spiral of the nuclear arms race, justified in the name of an interim possession of nuclear weapons. And I conclude with just a few examples of that. In 1978, a number of Protestant Catholic leaders signed a call to faithfulness, which said, our primary allegiance to Jesus Christ and his kingdom commits us to total abolition of nuclear weapons. There can be no qualifying or conditioning used. We, the signers of this declaration, commit ourselves to non-cooperation with our country's preparation for nuclear war. On all levels, research, development, testing, production, deployment, and actual use of nuclear weapons, we commit ourselves to resist in the name of Jesus. And it had people like Robert McAfee Brown, Henry Nouwen, Catholics like Nouwen and Bishop Thomas Gumbleton, Dorothy Day. Also had a number of evangelicals like Ted Engstrom, the president of World Vision, Jay Kessler, the president of Youth for Christ, and so on. In January 1982, Newsweek reported that 29 U.S. Catholic bishops had recently declared that even to possess nuclear weapons is wrong. And the Catholic bishops are moving that way, although we'll have to wait and see what they decide this fall. Finally, interestingly enough, President Reagan's pastor, Don Mumma, is a nuclear pacifist, and he has preached that in sermons at Bel Air Presbyterian Church, and I quote, because nuclear weapons are so destructive, so devastating, so final, so widespread, they are ethically and morally indefensible. I must be a nuclear pacifist. I want to conclude with this passage from Mark. I said yesterday that this topic is a heavy one that tends to make us all feel depressed and mesmerized. And I don't think that's the response. And as I was reading this morning in a little book by Andrew Murray with Christ in the School of Prayer, I was struck again about the incredible statement that Jesus made about prayer. And I'd like to suggest that that we claim the promise that Jesus makes here and apply it to the nuclear question. Jesus said, truly I say to you that whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you receive it, and you will. That's Mark chapter 11, verses 22 to 24. The nuclear question certainly seems like one of those huge mountains outside the village that cannot be moved. Jesus is using imagery which suggests that precisely the most intractable problems are the ones that we ought to have prayer and faith about, and genuinely believe that God will change things. And my hope is that within the Church of Jesus Christ around the world,
there'll be a larger and larger movement of folk who will make prayer and dependence on the Holy Spirit central to their resistance to the madness of the nuclear arms race. Okay, what comments, questions do you have?
Yeah. Do you think in the 20th century we would have had a just war, according to your 7 points?
I'd rather turn that around and let you all struggle with that.
Well, Poland then should have resisted against the Germans in the Second World War because there was really no hope that they'd survive. We flew 1,000 planes again and again over German cities and demolished the whole city. So that was an act of gross anathema. It seems to me the Korean War, Vietnam, wherever you turn. Sure, the Russians' invasion of Afghanistan, their use of yellow rain, all the rest of these things. I don't think we've had a just war.
India's war of independence with Mahatma Gandhi might be a just war.
That was almost entirely a nonviolent action.
There were specific acts of violence in specific places, but it was mostly nonviolent, and it worked. Yeah. And their violent wars hadn't for 150 years before that.
I'd rather not take us too far afield from the nuclear question.
No, other than you base that upon the fact that we should make our stand on the basis that nuclear war would allow us to be
I think when you're quoting from Mark, I think Jesus' words about the person who calls his brother a fool has committed murder. And when you mentioned murder, you also went to the more distant interpretations of that when you said the person who is doing, in the second of your criticisms of Hare's work, you said the one who is preparing nuclear warheads, even though the government has a secret that they're not going to use them, is involved in the business of murder and therefore be excluded. Anyway, I get the feeling that maybe it would be better if we could deal with the question of the alternatives to the nuclear possibility on a secular level rather than on a religious one. Because how we made the how we handled the differences between calling our brother a fool and conventional weapons, I think though it was handled maybe religiously, I think probably it was handled as well in secular fashion, and maybe in some terms we could now also. In order to relieve us of the feeling that there, on the one hand, that there is a sinless alternative that we might choose, and then the exclusion of those who choose otherwise. I mean, when the church pronounces, even if it's not some kind of anathema on those who think otherwise within their fold, even if they say, well, this is a guiding policy statement, it seems to me that it leads us along the path of preserving innocence rather than confession of guilt. And the preserving of innocence is not really a religious stance, not Christian at least.
Well, I don't think that the concern is preservation of personal innocence. I think the concern is faithfulness to biblical revelation and the ethic of Jesus, and a love for neighbor, and a concern for what is in the best interest of the neighbor. We certainly don't want to sin so that grace may abound.
I agree, but the secular man has love for neighbor also.
Yeah,
that's why
I think
I say we don't have greater light as Christians to resolve the world's problems. I don't believe in.
Well, I would like to think that we do have in biblical revelation ethical insight that goes beyond the general wisdom that the average person has. And that furthermore, in the renewing, transforming power of the risen Christ in our lives, we've got the spiritual energy to dare to apply that ethic. At least I think that's what the New Testament says is true, isn't it?
I don't think so.
No.
I think you have the second, you don't need the first. And you have a bond with secular culture. Then the church is not pharisaical.
I guess my reading is that certainly Phariseeism has been a problem, and legalism has been a problem, and self-righteousness has been a problem. But I rather suspect that the greater problem most of the time in the church is cheap grace and a kind of sellout to status quo and a failure to live out the kind of values that Jesus taught.
I grant that
big
too.
Debate.
That it's a problem, not that it's a greater.
One other thing, I certainly don't for a moment mean to suggest that we not work with secular people. I think the secular people are doing all kinds of fantastic things on this issue. In some cases, they're ahead of the church. Thank God for that. And I certainly want to, and I'm going to suggest a policy of civilian-based defense for the whole society, which Christians and non-Christians alike would work together on. But I get there because of biblical revelation and the ethic of Jesus.
I would not want to suggest we shouldn't discuss these issues in the church either. But I'd like to see maybe more explicit openness to opposite positions than we come to when we say, well, this is the ethic of Jesus.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how we can separate our faith from our daily lives. I think it's our faith that informs our everyday decisions, no matter how small or how large they must be. And to say that we have religious things on one hand and secular things on another just isn't congruent with our faith. Also, as Christians, we need to be able to discuss openly and learn how to do that, to discuss these things with other people who are not so Christian, but not to divorce our faith from our lifestyle.
I agree. Very much.
Just to sharpen, again, it seems to me the question, like the just war issue, seems to get to the argument about whether we argue for war or against war, totally, so that we get to it. You get into the social system, the feelings, like, for me, that to talk about it, to talk against nuclear war is to talk against war altogether.
That's not the thrust of this position.
Yeah, I want to.
This position is saying that, the people I've mentioned, a number of them, certainly the whole Catholic tradition and the popes, have very carefully put their positions against nuclear war in such a way that they're not denying the earlier Catholic tradition of justifying a certain kind of use of lethal violence. But they're saying nuclear weapons are different. Because they destroy so many people, you can't use them without killing a large number of civilians, etc. So it's important, I think, to see that this argument comes within the just war tradition. People who think that war has been justified at times in the past and might be again today, conventional war, limited conventional war, but not nuclear war. Yeah.
Whenever I talk to people about the issue in our congregation, the question of deterrence always comes up.
Mm.
And very seldom do you ever hear anybody talk about just war anymore. At least I have. I hear deterrent. Mm-hmm. When I read Jonathan Schell's book, Fate of the Earth, he spent a lot of time talking about deterrence being a ridiculous position. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. How do you feel about that? I mean, is he right when he said that deterrence, there's no deterrence is just a stupid argument?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to look at the pieces of it. I have tried to argue that there are a number of ways deterrence could fail. And I find that quite persuasive. But my own conclusion, my gut, is that I think if we continue possessing nuclear weapons, we're almost certainly going to get to a point where it will fail. But, you know, one has to look at each of the different reasons why or how it might fail and examine that and see if that seems to have force.
Is the alternative to deterrence that unilateral disarmament?
Yes and no, no and yes. I'm not in favor of unilateral disarmament. I'm in favor of what I call transarmament. I'm in favor of defending our society, not giving up defending it. But I want to use an alternative to nuclear weapons. And I'll spell that out Thursday. You better stop. I'm glad to go on chatting with those of you who want to come up and talk a bit about it, but I think we should let everybody go. Our hour's up.